Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on May 29, 2018. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Sabbasabha Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha teaches the ending of mental fermentations through appropriate or refined mindfulness. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
So the Buddha teaches that there are three basic defilements that arise from a mind rooted in wrong and views ignorant of Four Noble Truths: greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. In the introduction, I reference another sutta where the Buddha breaks that down into 16 different defilements, but they can all be seen in that as greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. And again, these arise because we don't understand who we are in relation to the environment that we live in. All things are impermanent. And so we continually strive to establish a permanent self based on these wrong views. And it results in that initial grasping for a self-referential existence is greed or desire. And it leads to these other defilements or fermentations of the mind. Fermentations is a good word to use, isn't it? Because once we have established wrong views, it's like these views just ferment in our mind and make us ever more rooted in wrong views. And so, as we all know, that's the primary difficulty, isn't it? Is recognizing and abandoning wrong views. We got into this in much deeper on the retreat, but how we one thought, depending on the view and intention behind it, has two different results. One thought could incline the mind towards awakening, or it could continue ignorance. And so it's a well-concentrated mind, having developed a refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path, that is able to see these things and abandon them. The Buddha was at Savatthi, at Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery, where we presented this teaching. Friends, the ending of the fermentations is for one who knows and understands skillful and unskillful mindfulness. There's so much just in that one beginning sentence. Mindfulness of in and of itself is not the answer to our problems. Mindfulness means to hold in mind or to recollect, and we can do that with anything, including unskillful thoughts. And it's not just the most obvious thoughts, such as, using myself as an example, for a long, long time, long before I came to Buddhism, I had an outstanding mindfulness practice. Without ever meditating, without ever coming across the Eightfold Path, my mindfulness was well established. I could not stop thinking about the next drink or drug. That's mindfulness. It's unskillful mindfulness, though, isn't it? I'm using that as an extreme example, but being mindful of holding wrong views is just as devastating as far as developing the Dhamma is concerned. The ending of fermentations is not possible by one who... there's a critical... Did anybody read this article?
I did, but I wouldn't spot spelling mistakes anyway.
Oh, because it's missing a very important word. I'll explain. The ending of the fermentations is not possible by one who does know or understand. There should be a not in there.
Yeah.
I think I was a little knotted up when I wrote this. The ending of the fermentations is not possible by one who does not know or understand skillful and unskillful mindfulness. When one is inappropriately mindful, fermentations arise and increase. When one is skillful in their application of mindfulness, additional fermentations do not arise, and present fermentations are abandoned. Again, think about all the different suttas that the Buddha teaches different applications of mindfulness, but always rooted in the four foundations of mindfulness. That type of mindfulness is absolutely required if we're going to recognize and abandon greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. Friends, there are seven ways to abandon fermentations. One, there are fermentations that are to be abandoned by understanding. And one lacking instruction of the Eightfold Path, having no regard for the Dhamma or for those of integrity, those who have integrated the Dhamma, this one cannot discern what is skillful to be mindful of and what is unskillful. This one cannot be mindful of what it is necessary to hold in mind. They are lacking the framework for clear knowing provided by the Eightfold Path. Again, simple instructions. If you want to develop appropriate mindfulness, you develop the Eightfold Path. And what are ideas that are unskillful to be mindful of? Whatever ideas that, when held in mind, develop sensual craving or increase sensual craving. Through unskillful sensual craving, establishment of self-craving develops. It continues and it increases. When sensual craving increases, ignorance does as well. In other words, when we continually give in to our desires, which is, there's actually teachings that say that we should do that so that we ultimately will get sick of it. It doesn't work. But even on a much more subtle way, when we're constantly giving in or feeding self-referential views for just feeling that I need to have this or that, I need to have another piece of chocolate cake, I need to have another drink, I need to listen to another whatever, another YouTube video, whatever it might be, those are constant distractions that reaffirm wrong views. And appropriate mindfulness teaches us to recognize these things that continue to lead us towards ever-increasing ignorance and deliver us towards awakening. These are ideas that are to be mindfully recognized and mindfully abandoned. Again, simple and direct instruction. And what are ideas to be appropriately mindful of? Any idea that does not or that do not develop sensual craving or increase sensual craving. Appropriate or right mindfulness releases any sensual craving that has developed, and no establishment of craving for a self arises, and the fermentation of ignorance is abandoned. These are ideas that are unskillful to hold in mind. So remember this, that series with Vajragoda and Anuradha, the Malankyaputta Sutta, concluding with the Kula Sakaka Sutta. Remember all those?
Yes, John.
The Buddha's going to reference those great existential questions, but he's really talking about any questions that's rooted in a self-referential view, continued eye making. But in these, he uses the example of, did I exist in the past? Did I not exist in the past? And think about either one of those. They're just taking you out of what's occurring in the present moment, which is where we apply right mindfulness. Will I exist in the future? Will I not exist in the future? Where am I now? Where am I not? Meaning, do I not exist? Or where do I not exist? Which is getting into that those questions we looked at the Kula Sakaka Sutta. Where have I come from? We had a great discussion on the origins of ignorance. It's the same thing that question comes from. Where do I come from? What difference does it matter? What difference does it make? You're here now. Knowing how you got here is only relevant when you realize that your mind got here in this state from ignorance. Holding in mind these unskillful ideas, six confused and deluded views will arise. The view that I have a self is established. The view that I have no self is established, nothingness or emptiness, we talked about that last week, or annihilation. I have a self because I perceive a self, that phrase, I think, therefore I am. That is the essence of self-referential views in one sentence, even though it's been accepted. I have a self because I perceive that I am not a self. This is confused and discursive thinking. Simply that we can get caught up in these ruminations to a mind rooted in ignorance proves that there's some validity in being stuck in it. Why? Because I'm simply thinking this way. So the thoughts must be useful because I have the thoughts. This is the problem that the Buddha addressed while he was considering, how can I teach this Dhamma? How does a deluded mind know that it's deluded? How does a mind rooted in ignorance know that it's rooted in ignorance? Remember the Nagara Sutta. The Buddha describes very clearly getting stuck in this feedback loop of self-referential ideas, stuck in this revolving consciousness, thinking rooted in wrong views. How do you get out of it? An Eightfold Path. I have a self because I perceive a self that I am not a self. I am not a self because I perceive a self that is not a self. I am constant, everlasting, eternal, never changing. That's the idea of having an individual, self-identified soul that travels or transmigrates through time, eons and eons and eons. Never changing. And of course, we understand the Dhamma that in order to understand what a self is, we have to see the self in a state of constantly becoming. No matter how far along the line we are towards awakening or even an awakened state, we're in a constant state of becoming. And that points to the importance of being mindful of what's occurring. Because it is only in this moment, by having our mind and body united with what's occurring, that we even have the opportunity to awaken, or the possibility, I should say. So developing this right mindfulness, understanding what is skillful to hold in mind and what is unskillful to hold in mind and so abandon, allows us to develop right view right here and now. And even if we're at the beginning stages of becoming awakened, we will have now established ourselves in the only place where we can awaken, right here, right now. We cannot awaken in the future. We certainly can't awaken from past deeds, can we? We have to find a way to not be distracted by the constant need of a self-referential ego self to continue to establish itself. And that is expressed by greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. It's what the Buddha taught is developed through an eightfold path rooted in concentration and then integrating all the other seven factors of the eightfold path. The Buddha now describes all these ways of thinking and trying to establish the self and ignore our own ignorance as, this is a thicket of views that binds one to endless confusion, delusion, and suffering, that binds one to endless dukkha, endless suffering. Let go of the views. Again, the Buddha used that term anatta to not get into some mystical explanation of no such thing as a self or emptiness. He simply used a common term of his time in a completely different way to remind us that these views that we're holding of a self are not a self. Is Frank okay? The Buddha continues, one who is well instructed in the Dhamma, who has developed the Eightfold Path, who has high regard for the Dhamma and those with integrity in regards to the Dhamma, discerns what ideas are skillful to be mindful of and are to be cultivated, and what ideas are unskillful to be mindful of and to be abandoned. Again, does it fit within the framework of the Eightfold Path? That's how we know. This one remains mindful of skillful qualities and remains free of unskillful qualities. Having developed a refined mindfulness framed by the Eightfold Path, they remain mindful of, guess what he references here?
Cows.
Pardon me?
Cows.
Yes. Yeah, ultimately, yes. They remain mindful of, this is stress, the first noble truth. This is the origination of stress, craving and clinging, the second noble truth. This is the cessation of stress, the third noble truth. And the Eightfold Path is the path developing the cessation of stress. This is what we hold in mind as Dhamma practitioners hoping to awaken. And it's certainly not beyond our human capabilities, is it? It's a very simple and direct teaching that does take initial right effort, concerted effort, right intention, simply because of a mind rooted in ignorance, creates all these strategies mentioned here to allow it to ignore its own ignorance. And it's a constant It's a constant struggle, whether we recognize it or not. It takes continual mindful effort to maintain wrong views, especially once we know the difference. But even when we don't, we're struggling against. It's hard to put this in words, but I'll use words that might be confusing. It's hard to struggle against what we naturally are, even when we don't know it. Because we create this constant stress of maintaining a self rather than letting go of all those views. Everything okay, Frank?
Yes.
With this refined mindfulness, the fermentations of identity view, the Buddha's words translated, or self-referential or eye-making views, confusion and grasping after or clinging to unskillful precepts and rituals, these are fermentations that are directly abandoned by right understanding or right view. There are fermentations that are to be abandoned by restraint. We talked about that a lot, practicing restraint at the point of contact. With the refined mindfulness developed through the framework of the Eightfold Path, this one remains restrained and not distracted by contact with the eyes or the nose or the tongue or the ear or the body or the intellect. The fermentations that would arise in those unrestrained at the six senses do not arise in one who has developed restraint. Again, simple and indirect teachings. And what's that one word that always conduces, or that one phrase, that one thought that always conduces towards awakening? You can't answer.
It is not me, it is not
my. Yeah. And that's what the Buddha's talking about. That's in at that moment of contact, when we find ourselves getting drawn back into the world again, remind ourselves, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am.
The violence can flow back in.
Yes. Oh, of course.
Excuse me, I'm going to kill that.
So it takes continual mindfulness, especially as we're developing the Dhamma. And our meditation practice is the perfect training, because we're doing the same thing on our cushions, but in a much more direct way. We're getting caught up in our thoughts, which is the same as getting caught up in the world again. We recognize it at the point of contact. In meditation, hopefully that point of contact is simply within us. It's within our intellect. We remember what we're doing, come back to the sensation of breathing. And every time we do that, we're interrupting the continual flow of ignorance in a very practical and direct way. That's the proper use of meditation. Number three, there are fermentations that are to be abandoned by proper use of what is necessary without creating an identity view from using this. This one uses a robe solely for protection and modesty. In other words, the Buddha is talking about anything that we might do to reaffirm or aggrandize the self. So the Buddha, very quickly, within a few weeks of his awakening, was already being showered with things like brand new robes, which he wouldn't take. He continually wore cast-off robes made of rags to make the point, but also so that he didn't get caught up in, if it was possible at that point, of needing finer robes or maybe even something else. He's pointing to a way of living in the world in a practical way. We all need robes. In fact, the Buddha would teach that as human beings, we need four things. We need food, shelter, clothing, and medicine. Those are reasonable things. Those aren't things that we should deny ourselves, or we're falling into asceticism, aren't we? But we should also not create self-referential views by having the most wonderful clothes or the most wonderful. And it's okay to have nice clothes and a nice house as long as we're not creating an identity over it. This one uses a robe solely for protection and modesty. This one uses food not for entertainment or for intoxication or for growing large. I love that. Or for beautification, but simply for the survival and continuation of the body so that the Eightfold Path can be fully developed. It's good to take care of our physical needs for this reason. This one uses lodging solely for protection and enjoyment of seclusion. This one uses medicine for the purpose of curing sickness and to be free of pain and disease. The fermentations of unskillful using, meaning creating an identity from what is used, are abandoned by skillful using.
Something keeps popping up. I'm afraid I'll lose the recording.
Sorry about that. Four, there are fermentations that are to be abandoned by tolerated. One who tolerates, who abandons reaction to worldly causes and conditions, such as cold or heat or wind or harsh words or unpleasant sensations or nagging insects, will not give rise to fermentations and remain free of those fermentations by tolerating what is occurring. It simply means that no matter what's occurring, even if it's nasty insects, to not take it personal and understand that no matter what it is, it's temporary in nature. And if I remind myself that this is not happening to me, it's simply occurring, there's no eye making in that. And of course, if it's really buggy, it's okay to go find some shelter. Or if it's really cold or rainy, etc. The Buddha didn't just live out on a desert waiting to bake himself to a crisp. He took shelter, but he took appropriate shelter. When in northern India, just like today, there were the monsoon seasons. During those 3 or 4 months, he knew it was foolish to be traipsing all around northern India because you couldn't get anywhere. So they stayed in one place, usually Anathapindika's monastery, for practical reasons. By tolerating what is occurring. Five, there are fermentations that are to be abandoned by avoiding. One who mindfully avoids sitting in unsuitable seats, prone to distraction or eye making. A good example of this, when I first sobered up, one of the things that I was told, but I kind of readily agreed, was you can't hang around, if you want to stay sober, you can't hang around in bars or those old friends. Makes sense, doesn't it? But if I did, which many people try to do, you simply fall back in that routine. You can't help but be affected by that. It's just a practical example of how to develop the Dhamma. If we know we've been in situations that have prone to lead us towards distraction and mindlessness, simply stop putting yourself in those situations. This one avoids sitting with wild animals or sitting in brambles or in a cesspool or other unsuitable habitats. I think I might have sat in a cesspool once too, but I don't really remember.
I don't think you'd have to be told not to do that.
I know.
You'd think, but apparently there were a lot of folks during the Buddha's time that just, he's making a point. Or other unsuitable habitats. This one avoids association with unskillful people. This one avoids fermentations by avoiding what is skillful to avoid. There are fermentations that are to be abandoned by destroying arisen thoughts. This, Matt used the word crushing. And I think destroying is maybe a little bit more pleasant. These are fermentations that are to be abandoned by destroying arisen thoughts of ill will or cruelty. This one abandons hurtful thoughts, words, and deeds and eliminates them from their existence. With a well-controlled mind, we can recognize these hurtful thoughts and we can actually eliminate them. And remember in the other, in the Anapanasati Sutta, once they're gone, once all of the remnants of these ignorant thoughts are gone, they no longer arise. Helen, get it?
I just said fermentations.
Fermentations, yeah, thank you. 7, there are fermentations that are to be abandoned by developing the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. With the refined mindfulness developed through the Eightfold Path, they remain mindful of awakening, dependent on seclusion, dependent on dependent on dispassion, on cessation, on release from clinging to wrong views. They develop an understanding of the qualities of persistence, inspiration, serenity, concentration, and equanimity as factors of awakening. Remember, both the Satipatthana and the Anapanasati Sutta speaks to these. Having developed this understanding through the Eightfold Path, the fermentations are abandoned. Again, just reminding us, it's through the Eightfold Path. And as far as the Buddha is concerned, there's no other path. It's the only one he taught. When a Dhamma practitioner has abandoned the fermentations through understanding, through restraint, through proper using, through tolerating, through avoiding and destroying and developing, this one has severed all craving and clinging and has ended all fetters through right understanding of conceit of I-making. I want to read that again because it really tells us exactly what to do. When a Dhamma practitioner has abandoned the fermentations through understanding, through restraint, through proper using, through tolerating, through avoiding, through destroying and developing, this one, developing the Eightfold Path, this one has severed all craving and clinging and has ended all the fetters through right understanding. The right understanding of I-making. This one has ended all confusion, delusion, and unsatisfactory experiences. It's the end of the sutta. Thank you. So, any questions about how to do this?
I like how they bookend the 7 with right view and developing your practice.
Yeah.
Everything else was kind of like showing restraint. But those bookend of right view and refining your practice is that's the meat of abandoning.
Yes.
Everything else seemed to be like some good advice to say not accessible.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's bookended by essentially the Eightfold Path.
Exactly. As all of his teachings are, and he's just giving practical advice. To people to recognize what it is that you need to avoid if you're going to develop the Dhamma. A self-referential ego self has difficulty letting go of anything, even sleeping in a cesspool, if that's what it thinks is good for itself. The Buddha is pointing out the foolishness and maybe the insanity of maintaining wrong views. And how do you do it? By initial right view, accepting that the views that you hold may not be the most skillful views, and developing the rest of the path through the Eightfold Path. So thank you for recognizing. Any other questions or comments tonight, David?
I think I'm good for the rest of the
day. Thank you. Lorna, good to see you tonight.
Good to be here, thank you. It happened this morning, in my morning meditation this morning. I had a kind of unusual meditation in as much as I sit for 30 minutes in the morning, and about 10 minutes, about 10 minutes into my meditation anyway, for some reason, you know how like when you're meditating, your body is not always compliant to meditation.
You
kind of like lean back and then you have to correct yourself, or lean forward and correct yourself, or something like that. There's always, your mind often goes to your body for something.
Yeah. Has anybody ever watched me while I'm meditating?
Well, this morning, for some, it was different. My body seemed to want to meditate. It seemed to, I've got the word, you know, that just to
comply.
That's it. Yeah. It just complied with what my mind was doing, and not in a heavy state, but I would say I kind of went to stone, but not in it. I didn't feel heavy. It just, there was absolutely no movement. There was nothing wanting to move, and I was balanced. I didn't correct my balance or correct my shift on the cushion or anything. I was just, I think if you videoed me, I just would look like I was made out of stone. There was nothing moving. And I haven't felt that quite so prominently. I mean, you have bits of things when you ask it, but this went on and on and on to the rest of my meditation, maybe about 20 minutes. And I didn't move a muscle. My head didn't drop, you know, go back. Nothing happened. I was just completely, my body was completely compliant to my mind.
That's a profound experience of a body and a mind united.
Yeah, it was. I've never had it like that.
You mentioned sitting like a stone. There's a, okay, I don't know exactly where it was, but the Buddha talks about sitting like a mountain. Nothing's gonna penetrate that, is it, during your meditation? Mm. That's wonderful. Thank you for sharing it. Ron, good to see you tonight.
Mm. Good to be here. I've been realizing that at times I see these fermentations and I'm actually arguing with myself that it's my birthright. I should have these fermentations, damn it.
Yeah, you deserve them.
Yeah, I deserve them. Yeah. Yeah, why should I give them up? I'm having so much fun. Yeah, and not just, and it can go with all the fermentations.
Yeah.
And it's kind of hard to get, to abandon things when you're in that mindset.
Yeah, especially when you're, well, because you are identified with the views. You've created a self out of those views. How can you let them go? Thank you. Mary, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good to be here. Good to see you. After all, it's been a noble silence.
Thank you. Helen, good to see you.
Thank you. Good to be here. I don't know that I have much to add either. I think I still grumble good-naturedly to get it out of my system when I have to. Like if something goes wrong, I'll grumble about it, knowing nothing's going to change by the grumbling, just kind of need to, and then I'm okay. I guess, you know, I do that kind of mini fermenting. fully aware that I'm doing it, I think, you know, I'm trying to be good-natured about it. Because, you know, every day there's a potential for something to go wrong.
Yeah.
So, I'm aware of it.
Oh, I'm sorry. It sounds, I mean, that's the beginning of awareness is the foundation to change it. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like your awareness is not leading to beating yourself up over it.
No,
and that's the key. Yeah. Again,
it sounds appropriate.
Well, yeah, and the brilliance of an awakened human being's path is that it's the middle way, meaning it allows us to be human beings. If it insisted that we be something other than what we are, it'd be useless, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Although a lot of those spiritual paths during his time and our time are like that. We need to meet it to be different than we are. The Buddha teaches us
to first develop radical acceptance of who we are, no matter what is occurring, no matter what we're doing in this present moment. And we learn the difference between approval and acceptance, don't we? But that is a key, awareness, but a gentle awareness. Look what I'm doing. Thank you. Patricia, good to see you again. Welcome back to your Sangha.
I don't have much to add, but I'm definitely back to here. I can feel lots of clutter getting moved around for the first time in a while. So it felt good. Yeah. I could definitely tell it's not far from where my practice used to be, but it's good to see that I'm doing the work again.
Yeah, well, again, welcome back to our Sangha.
Yeah.
As you're reinvigorating your meditation practice, start with short periods of meditation, whatever you feel comfortable with, but 2, 3, 4, or 5 minutes, if you can do that twice a day, is more than enough to get going. And then gradually add some time, and of course, keep coming back to our Sangha.
Thank you.
And again, you get the email that I send out?
I do, yeah.
Okay, good. So that points you to things that we're doing this week, and mm-hmm. you could even go back to the page for new visitors just to kind of reorient yourself that way. And again, feel free to send me any email if you have some questions. Glad you're back. Diane, good to see you tonight.
Thank you for continuing on and on and on. Appreciate it. Somewhere in the beginning of it, I thought, that's not people pleasing. That's talking that you don't have to people please. And I thought, wow, I mean, that's something that I was like raised with, and if you're not pleasing people, then you're doing it wrong.
Yep.
I just wish that, I mean, I think one of the things that I've done kind of, I mean, why I beat myself up is when I was growing up, it was all Christianity and you needed to be saved, and the people that were saved were like, wow, they had a change everything right then and there, and I keep expecting that. I mean, like today I was agitated, and I expect to instantaneously, because I know of the Eightfold Path, and I'm practicing it, and I'm meditating, that I should have it down right now and be peace and calm, and it's chipping away at the self-loathing and that kind of stuff. It's chipping away, and I'm just really grateful for that.
Me too. And it's really similar to what Helen was talking about. You know, we and why I keep saying we have to be gentle with ourselves. You know, I learned that from, you know, a pretty wise guy. I learned it from the Buddha. Because that's how he was. Even when he was direct, saying things like, you foolish person, he was doing that out of great compassion. And we need to embody that with ourselves. We need to realize that there's nothing wrong with being rooted in wrong views. If there's anything unskillful about it, is to understand that we're rooted in wrong views and then do nothing about it. But even then, it doesn't do any good to beat yourself up. But the Buddha recognized a common problem to all humanity. So we're not unique. And when we start taking it personally, when we start thinking I should be meditating better, or I should understand this quicker, or any other things that we might put on ourselves within the framework of the Dhamma, is itself rooted in ignorance. The Buddha teaches radical acceptance, meaning whatever is occurring outside or within is to be accepted, period. Not accepted why, or not with excuses, or not any kind of reasoning. We accept it and accept ourselves simply because this is what's occurring. This is who I am. And the reason why that's the only way we can change, it goes back to one of my teachers. You heard me say it many times. Arnold Patton. If you're in New York and you want to get to Chicago, but you believe you're in Los Angeles, you're not getting anywhere. We have to first allow ourselves to be who we are. And the only way we can do that is to remove judgment, especially self-judgment. Thank you.
It also goes back to putting yourself back into right view.
Yep.
So you can recognize you're in wrong view, you can be gentle with yourself. Mm-hmm. But you have to do the other work, which is to get back into right view and right effort, you know. I think we talked about it on the retreat that, you know, when you're in those moments and you're experiencing something that, you know, is agitating you or insert whatever, that is pulling you off the path, the best thing to do is reorient yourself to the Dhamma.
Yeah.
And you know, and that speaks to right effort, it speaks to what David was just saying, what Sue was just saying too. That to take it just a little bit further, or at least that was a new appreciation I experienced, that when I went into those things, the example I used was when I've had a really hard day, sometimes just getting out and walking for 5 miles, mm-hmm. Nature is my solution, but the real solution and my takeaway was, there's nothing wrong with the walk, but it really is about right effort and going back to the Dhamma and reorient yourself to the Eightfold Path and get back on the path again.
Yeah, and isn't that taking a walk by yourself is seclusion, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's what the Buddha teaches us to do.
Yeah,
and the other, Lorna brought up too, and we did, we talked a lot about this. What do you do when you're caught up in it? Read a sutta, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta,
right,
or
exactly.
Any sutta that has meaning to you. Or sometimes it is simply take a breath and just that the one thought, this is not me. But whatever we have to do, the Buddha provided. It's 84,000 discourses because they speak to a situation. He never taught something different in those, but situationally they apply in all different ways. But they all come back to integrating the Eightfold Path, living an integrated life. That's how we do it.
And even in the sutta, the Buddha addresses where people are on the path.
Yep.
Whether you're entering the stream or awakened, You are where you're at, and so he addresses that. So it may, all those middle parts of showing restraint, that might just be for the folks who are down the line a little bit, who are still beginning. And
oh yeah.
So it's beautifully written in that it's repetitive, but it keeps talking about kind of where you're at.
Yeah, that's great insight. When you look at it this way, he's essentially saying the same thing,
mm-hmm.
line after line after line, in slightly different ways. So it why? So he can so he can penetrate the ignorant minds in front of him and reinforce the minds that are on the way to awakening. And at the same time, just like you described, I should probably leave it there because you said it beautifully. The Dhamma is appropriate for anyone at any time. Even an awakened one, it's good to hear it. One of these days, I keep saying I'm going to do it next week, but one of these weeks I'm going to teach about Mahakasapa. And here's a guy, 80 years old, living exactly how he lived for all those years. He was a contemporary of the Buddha. The Buddha called him in and said, you don't have to live such a harsh life. And Kasapa, and I won't get into the whole thing, but Kasapa basically said, this is how I live and it's important for me to live this way as an example. Nothing else there. This is he lived that way because that's how he lived. Nothing else. Bonnie, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good to see you too. I'm feeling good.
Good.
And I'm just gonna keep listening and try not to ferment.
Thank you. Hi Liz, how are you?
I'm good, John. How are you?
I'm good.
Time to time, the suttas start sounding a little dogmatic to me and sort of brings up my resistance to dogma. And so my antidote is to just go back to the simplicity of the concept of the skillful use of the Dhamma and how the Eightfold Path folds back into the Four Noble Truths.
Yeah.
And I sort of cleanse myself of any notions of dogma and just stick to the simplicity of all that.
Yeah. Wow, beautiful. That's a good reminder for when we start getting caught up in that. You know, just come right back to it. Thank you, Liz. Frank, good to see you tonight. We've missed you.
Good to be here tonight. See everybody. That was it's an important suit to keep in mind. I'm dealing with the everyday frustrations that I run into. But this past month and a half has been kind of challenging for me. I came down with an illness that could not be explained through, you know, modern medicine. There was no answer, except I had, it was debilitating. And so it was, and I kept my meditation practice up 30 minutes in the morning and 20, 25 minutes in the afternoon. Plus, I wasn't sleeping at night because it seemed like every time I went to bed, it was when the attack of the head spins and whatever was going on was happening while I was trying to sleep. Mm-hmm. So I would lay in bed at night and I would cut through all of that fog and just grab the breath and kind of just be with the breath. And so I was really thankful for meditation practice that I had, and I feel like it helped me rebound a little bit quicker, maybe. I feel like I'm on the other side of it a little bit. This is the first night that I've been out driving in a month and a half, like, other than work-related stuff. You don't care if I die off from working.
We do.
One of the interesting things that I found was, you know, typically my seclusion and my meditation is because of my entanglements with external things, and I'm coming in here for peace and for refuge and all that. Well, this became a place of entanglement of where I didn't want to be because it was confusing and it was foggy and it was painful, and I had to sit for a month and a half with all these ill feelings of my this vehicle right here that we call body. And I was seeing into the impermanence of my own physical being, and it was really frightening that I was so attached to this physical body and afraid to let go of what was happening. I wasn't able to control anything. I didn't know if I was dying. I didn't know if I had a stroke. I didn't know if I was like going to wake up the next day. And so I was kind of like just bombarded with all this fear, and I was like, you know what? Fear can keep me up all night long, but this meditation can make a nice, soft cushion for me to lay my head down, you know? And I don't know, it was interesting.
That's, you know, more, like, that's more than interesting.
Yeah.
It's profound, right?
Yeah.
You know, in the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the Buddha teaches that if you have no control over it, how could it be a self? How could it be you? And so these things, sickness, aging, and death, not getting what you want, etc., the Buddha's description of dukkha. And so you depersonalize the situation and you remember to come back to what's occurring, which is coming back to your breath. And, you know, thank you for sharing. I'm so glad you're here tonight. Russ, good to see you tonight. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Good.
I don't think I have much to add. I just find that I've had a lot of opportunities to be in nature while I'm on this coast. It's given me a chance to relax my mind a little bit,
mm-hmm.
and focus, which has been great, because sometimes you get so caught up in everything you do, and you're so separated from nature, you're so separated from everything, you're
mm-hmm.
distracted constantly. It's been nice. So I think that's helped my practice to focus my mind.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure it has.
Yeah.
Glad you're here tonight. You know, we mentioned it a few times, Mary mentioned it, Russ, and the importance of nature. Again, the Buddha and his Sangha, they could have easily, and you know, you would think they'd be more comfortable maybe, lived right in the town instead of outside the town in nature, but that was a place that just naturally grounded them. And then they walked into town to get what they need, which was a bowl of food every day. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that just what Mary suggested, it's not a bad idea to every now and then go take a walk on the towpath or something else like that, just to calm our minds and help, you know, unite our minds with our bodies. Another great way to do it is Qigong. You know, we're so fortunate, those that are on retreat know that, to have Matt as part of our Sangha, really more than that, he's much more than just a part of our Sangha. In some ways he is the Sangha. Just a little reminder. I think there was something I was going to mention, but
when does Matt do Qigong?
The third Saturday of each month.
I think it's the Saturday coming.
No, I think it was last while we were on retreat.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, last Saturday was the
this
18th.
Is the
so
last
that.
Last Saturday.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
No,
so
yeah.
Yeah, it'll be in
no.
in 2 more weeks from this. 2 more weeks from this Saturday, is his next next session, unless you pester him, maybe he'll add another one. So,
June 9th.
Oh yes, thank you. The I think you all know about the thing up at Juan on June 9th, but I'll just mention it even online. It's good for other people to hear it. The Four Nations Ensemble is putting on a series of concerts at Juan in the Meditation Hall to raise money for their construction of a new building. There'll be some, Reverend Dason will give, I think, 3 meditation and brief teachings during some breaks in the concert. So if you're interested, send me an email. We'll if you want to go together, we'll leave from here around 9:30 on Saturday morning, on June the 9th after our meditation class. We'll see what happens. I think we were all excited about it when we were there, but not realizing that it's kind of a long drive to up and back. But if there's any interest at all, I'll be going. So.
Are there still flyers?
Yep, right out there. Yeah. I mean, that, you know, that's, it's just a nice place to go, even though it's a long ride. It's a beautiful place to drive up to, and if we get there early enough, they'll have lunch for us. If not, there's some great places in town we can get a meal together too. So if you're thinking of going, send me an email, and we'll set it up.
June 9th.
Yeah, we'd leave here around 9:30. Pardon me?
Father, I was wondering when Father's
Day.
Okay.
Yeah, it would. I mean, I think we'd have a great time, you know, going up as a group and just being up there. All right, let's finish with Metta as we always do.
17th is Father's Day.
Yep.
So find your relaxed meditation posture and take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. These are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature, let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.